artillery fire well, and the NATO troops would have minimal air support. As usual, the worst part of the preliminary bombardment was the rockets, which lasted 2 minutes, the unguided missiles falling like hail. Though men died and vehicles exploded, the defending force was well prepared, and casualties were light. Woody switched on his thermal imaging sights. It allowed him to see roughly 1,000 yards, double the visual range. On the left side of the turret, the loader sat nervously, his foot resting lightly on the pedal that controlled the doors to the ammo compartment. The driver, in his coffin-sized box under the main gun, drummed his fingers on the control bar. "Heads up, friendlies coming in," McCall told his crew. "Movement reported to the east." "I see 'em," Woody acknowledged. Just a few infantrymen were returning from their forward listening posts. Not as many as there should have been, McCall thought. So many casualties over the past. "Target tank, 12 o'clock, Woody said. He squeezed the triggers on his yoke, and the tank seemed to leap from its first shot. The spent round ejected from the breech. The loader stomped his foot on the pedal. The door slid clear of the ammo compartment, and he pulled out another sabo round, turning it in a narrow circle to slam it in the breech. "Ready." Woody already had another target. He was largely on his own while McCall watched out for the whole platoon's front. The troop commander was calling in artillery fire. Immediately behind the first row of tanks, they saw dismounted infantrymen running to keep up with the tanks. 8-wheeled infantry carriers were mixed in as well. The Bradleys engaged them with their 25-millimeter guns as proximity-fused artillery rounds began to detonate 20 feet off the ground, showering the infantrymen with fragments. They couldn't miss. The Russian tanks advanced at half the normal 100-yard interval, concentrating on a narrow front. They were old T-55s, Woody saw, with obsolete 100-millimeter guns. He killed 3 before they could even see the NATO positions. One shell landed in the stone pile ahead of their tank, sending a mix of steel fragments and stone chips over the vehicle. Woody dispatched that tank with a heat round. Smoke rounds began falling. They didn't help the Russians at all. The electronic sights on the NATO vehicles saw right through it. More artillery fire landed on the cav now that the Russians could see well enough to direct fire in on their positions. And that began an artillery duel as NATO guns searched for the Russian batteries. "Antenna tank! Sabo!" The gunner locked his sights on the T-55 and fired. The round missed this time, and they reloaded another round. The second shot blew the turret into the sky. The thermal sight showed the bright dots of anti-tank missiles running downrange, and the fountaining explosions of the vehicles they hit. Suddenly, the Russians stopped. Most of the vehicles died in place, but some turned and ran off. "Cease fire! Cease fire!" McCall told his platoon. "Report in." 3-2 has a track blown off," one replied. The others were intact, protected by their stone revetments. 9 rounds fired, boss," Woody said. McCall and the loader opened their hatches to vent the acrid propellant smell out of the turret. The gunner pulled off his leather helmet and shook his head. His sandy hair was filthy. "You know, there's one thing I miss from the M-60. "What's that, Woody?" "We ain't got no hatch in the bottom. Nice to be able to take a piss without climbing outside." "Did you have to say that?" the driver moaned. McCall laughed. It was a moment before he realized why. For the first time, they'd stopped Ivan cold, without having to pull back at all. A good thing, since their current position didn't allow for that possibility. And how did the crew react? They were making jokes. USS Reuben James. O'Malley lifted off again. He was averaging 10 flight hours per day. 3 ships had been torpedoed, 2 more hit by submarine-launched missiles in the past 4 days, but the Russians had paid dearly for that. They'd sent perhaps as many as 20 submarines into Icelandic waters. 8 had died trying to get through the picket line of submarines that was the fleet's outer defense. More had fallen to the line of towed array ships whose helicopters were now backed up by those of HMS Illustrious. A bold Tango skipper had actually penetrated one of the carrier groups and put a fish into America's tough hide, only to be pounced on and sunk by the destroyer Charon. The carrier could now make only 25 knots, barely enough to conduct flight operations, but she was still there. Mike Force, Reuben James, Battleaxe, and Illustrious, was escorting a group of amphibs south for another landing. There were still bears in the woods, and Ivan would go for the amphibious warfare ships as soon as he had the chance. From 1,000 feet, O'Malley could see Nassau and 3 others to the north. Smoke rose from Keflavik. The Russian troops were getting no rest at all.
"Won't be easy for them to track in on us," Ralston thought aloud.
"You suppose those Russian troops have radios?" O'Malley asked.
"Sure."
"You suppose maybe they can see us from those hills, and maybe radio a submarine what they see?"
"I didn't think of that," the ensign admitted.
"That's all right. I'm sure Ivan did." O'Malley looked north again. There were 3,000 Marines on those ships. The Marines had saved his ass in Vietnam more than once. Reuben James and O'Malley had the inshore side of the small convoy, while the British ships and helos guarded to seaward. It was relatively shallow water. Their towed array sonars were reeled in.
"Willie, drop! Now, now, now!"
The first active sonoboy was ejected into the water. 5 more were deployed in the next few minutes. The passive buoys used for open ocean search were the wrong choice here. Stealth was not in the cards if the Russian subs were being informed where to go. Better to scare them off than to try finesse.
3 hours, O'Malley thought.
"Hammer, this is Romeo," Morris called. "Bravo and India are working a possible contact to seaward, 29 miles bearing 247.
"Roger that, Romeo," O'Malley acknowledged.
To Ralston.
"Bastards within missile range. That ought to make the Marines happy."
"Contact. Possible contact on buoy 4, Willie said, watching the sonar display. "Signal is weak." O'Malley turned his helo and moved back up the line. Keflavik, Iceland.
"Where do you suppose they are?" Andreev asked his naval liaison officer.
The position of the formation had been plotted on the map from the reports of several mountaintop lookout stations. The man shook his head.
"Trying to get to the targets."
The general remembered his own time aboard ship, how vulnerable he'd felt, how dangerous it had been. A distant part of his consciousness felt sympathy for the American Marines. But gallantry was a luxury the general could not afford. His paratroopers were heavily engaged, and he didn't need more enemy troops and heavy equipment.
Of course.
His division was deployed to keep the Americans away from the Reykjavik-Keflavik area as long as possible. His original orders remained operative. Deny the Keflavik airbase to NATO. That he could do, though it would mean the probable annihilation of his elite troopers. His problem was that Reykjavik Airport would be equally useful to the enemy, and one light division wasn't enough to cover both places. So now the Americans trailed their coats in plain view of his observers. A full regiment of troops, plus heavy weapons and helicopters that they could land anywhere they wished. If he redeployed to meet this threat, he risked disaster when he disengaged his forward units. If he moved his reserves, they would be in the open where naval guns and aircraft could massacre them. This unit was being moved, not to join the others deployed against his airborne infantrymen, but to exploit a weakness within minutes instead of hours. Once in place, the landing ships could wait for relative darkness or a storm and race unseen across the water to land-bound troops. How could he deploy his own forces to deal with that? His radars were finished. He had a single remaining SAM launcher, and the battleships had systematically exterminated most of his artillery.
How many submarines out there?
I don't know, Comrade General.
USS Reuben James. Morris watched the sonar plot. The Sonoboy contact had faded off after a few minutes. A school of herring, perhaps. The ocean waters abounded with fish, and enough of them on active sonar looked like a sub. His own sonar was virtually useless as his ship struggled just to keep up with the Phibs. A possible submarine to seaward. Every sub-contact was a possible cruise missile sub. Was all the Commodore needed to go to full speed. O'Malley was dipping his sonar now, trying to reacquire the lost contact. He was the only one who could keep up with things.
Romeo, this is Bravo. Be advised we are prosecuting a possible missile-carrying submarine.
Doug Perrin had to assume the worst case.
Roger that, Bravo.
According to the data link picture, three helicopters were backing battle axe up, and the British frigate had interposed herself on the line from the contact to the amphibious ships.
Be careful, Doug.
Contact, Willie said. I have an active sonar contact bearing 303, range 2-300. O'Malley didn't have to look at his tactical display. The submarine was between him and the Phibs.
Up, Dome!
The pilot hovered while the sonar transducer was winched in. The contact was alerted now. That made it harder.
Romeo, Hammer, we have a possible contact here.
Roger, understood.
Morris was looking at the display. He ordered the frigate to close at flank speed. Not a smart tactic. He had no choice but to pounce on the contact before it got within range of the Phibs.
Signal Nassau, we're working a possible contact.
Down Dome, O'Malley ordered. Drop it to 400 and hammer.
Willie activated the sonar as soon as the proper depth was reached. He got a screen full of echoes. The transducer was so close to the rocky bottom that nearly 20 rocky spires showed up. A swiftly running tide didn't help matters. Flow noise around the rocks gave numerous false readings on the passive plot also.
Sir, I got a whole lot of nothing here.
I can feel him, Willie. The last time we pinged, I bet we had him at periscope depth and he ducked down deep while we came over.
That fast?
Ralston asked.
That fast.
Skipper, one of these things might be moving a little.
O'Malley keyed his radio and got permission to launch from Morris. Ralston set the torpedo for circular search, and the pilot dropped it into the sea. The pilot keyed the sonar into his headphones. He heard the whine of the torpedo's propellers, then the high-frequency ping of its homing sonar. It continued to circle for 5 minutes, then switched over to continuous pinging. And exploded.
Explosion sounded funny, sir, Willie said.
Hammer, Romeo, report.
Romeo, Hammer, I think we just killed a rock.
O'Malley paused.
Romeo, there's a sub here, but I can't prove it just yet.
What makes you think that, Hammer?
Because it's one damned fine place to hide, Romeo.
Concur. Morris had learned to trust O'Malley's hunches. He called up the amphibious commander on Nassau.
November, this is Romeo. We have a possible contact. Recommend you maneuver north while we prosecute.
Negative, Romeo, the Commodore replied at once. Inja is working a probable, repeat probable contact that's acting like a missile boat. We're heading for our objective at max speed. Get him for us, Romeo.
Roger, out.
Morris set the phone back in place. He looked at his tactical action officer.
Continue to close the datum point.
Isn't this dangerous, rushing after a submarine contact? Calloway asked. Don't you have your helicopter to keep them at arm's length?
You're learning, Mr. Calloway.
It's dangerous, all right. I think they mentioned that the job could get that way when I was at Annapolis.
Both her jet turbines were running flat out, and the frigate's knife-edge bow sliced through the water at over 30 knots. The torque from her single screw gave the ship a 4-degree list to port as she raced to close the submarine.
This is getting nasty.
O'Malley could see the frigate's mast clearly now, the distinctive cross-trees well above the horizon as he hovered 50 feet over the water.
Talk to me, Willie.
Lots of bottom echo, sir. The bottom must look like a city, all these damn things sticking up. We got eddies. We got too many things here, sir. Sonar conditions suck. Go passive. The pilot reached up and flipped the switch to listen in. Willie was right. Too much flow noise. Think, he told himself. The pilot looked at his tactical display. The amphibs were a scant 10 miles away. He couldn't hear them on his sonar, but there was about a 30% chance that a submarine could. If we had him at antenna depth before, he probably has a fair idea where they are, but not good enough to shoot. Romeo, Hammer, can you warn the fibs off? Over. Negative, Hammer. They are running away from a probable contact to seaward. Great, O'Malley growled over the intercom. Prepare to raise dome, Willie. A minute later, they were heading west. This sub-driver's got real balls, the pilot said. He's got brains, too. O'Malley keyed his radio. Romeo, Hammer, put November's course track on your tactical display and transmit to my gadget. It took a minute. O'Malley blessed the unknown engineer who'd built this feature into the Seahawks' tactical computer. The pilot drew an imaginary line from their only contact on the sub and Nassau's projected course. Figure the sub is going at 20 to 25 knots. The pilot reached down and stabbed his finger on the glass tube. That's where the bastard is. How do you know? Ralston asked. O'Malley already had the Seahawk heading that way. 'Cause if I was him, that's where I'd be. Willie, next time we dip, keep the dome at exactly 100 feet. Tell you one other thing, Mr. Ralston. This guy thinks he's beat us. Nobody beats the Hammer. O'Malley circled over the spot he'd selected and brought the Seahawk into hover. Down dome, Willie. Passive search only. 100 feet. Listening, skipper. Seconds stretched out into minutes while the pilot worked his controls to keep the helicopter stationary. Possible contact bearing 162. Go active? Ralston asked. Not yet. Bearing is changing slowly. Now 159. Romeo, Hammer, we have a possible submarine contact. The helicopter's onboard computer transmitted the data to Reuben James. Morris altered course to bear down on the contact. O'Malley raised his sonar dome and deployed a sonobuoy to mark the position and hold the contact while he moved to another position. The frigate was now 4 miles from the helicopter. Down dome. Another minute's wait. Contact bearing 197. Buoy 6 shows contact bearing 142. Gotcha, sucker. Up dome, let's go get him. Ralston worked the attack system as O'Malley moved south to get right behind the target. He set their last torpedo for a search depth of 200 feet, and a snake course. Down dome. Contact bearing 298. Hammer! Willie punched the active sonar button. Positive contact bearing 298, range 600. Set, Ralston said immediately, and the pilot jammed his thumb on the red release button. The burnished green torpedo dropped into the water. And nothing happened. Skipper, the torp didn't activate. Dead torp, sir. There wasn't time to curse. Romeo, Hammer, we just dropped on a positive contact. Bad torpedo, negative function on the torp. Morris clenched his fist on the radio telephone receiver. He gave course and rudder orders. Hammer, Romeo, can you continue to track the target? Affirmative, he's running hard on course 220. Wait, turning north. Seems to be slowing down now. Reuben James was now 6,000 yards from the submarine. The ships were on converging courses, with each in firing range of the other. Crashed up. Morris ordered. In seconds, the entire ship was vibrating from the reverse power. The frigate slowed to 5 knots inside a minute,
and Morris ordered a speed of 3 knots, bare steerage way.
Prairie Masker?
Operating, sir,
the ship control officer confirmed.
Calloway had kept out of the way with his mouth shut, but this was too much.
Captain Morris, aren't we a sitting duck?
Yep, Morris nodded. But we can stop faster than he can. His sonar should just be coming back online, and we're not making enough noise to hear. Sonar conditions are bad for everybody.
It's a gamble, the captain admitted.
He radioed for another helicopter. Illustrious would have one to him in 15 minutes.
Morris watched O'Malley's helicopter on radar. The Russian sub had slowed and gone deep again.
"Vampire! Vampire!" the radar technician called. 2 missiles in the air.
"Bravo reports her helo just dropped on an SSG answer," the ASW officer sang out.
"This is getting complicated," Morris observed coolly. "Weapons free."
"Bravo has splashed 1 missile, sir. The other one's heading for the India."
Morris's eyes focused on the main display. A carrot symbol was marching toward HMS Illustrious, moving very fast.
"Evaluate Vampire as SSN-19. Bravo evaluates her contact as Oscar class. She reports a hit, sir."
4 helicopters were swarming around the down carrot submarine contact symbol now.
"Romeo, Hammer, the bastard's right underneath us. Bearing just reversed on us."
"Sonar, Yankee search on bearing 113.
Morris lifted the radio telephone.
"November, turn north now," he ordered the Nassau.
"India is hit, sir. The Vampire scored on India."
"Wait, India Hilo reports he dropped another torp on the contact."
Illustrious would have to look out after herself, Morris thought.
"Sonar contacts her bearing 118, range 1500.
The data went into the fire control director. The solution light blinked on.
"Set. Shoot."
Morris paused for a moment.
"Bridge, combat, all ahead flank. Come right to 010.
"Bloody hell," observed Mr. Calloway.
On the frigate's starboard side, the triple torpedo tube mount swung out and loosed a single fish. Below, the engineers listened to their engines go from idle to maximum power. The frigate settled at the stern as the propeller churned the water to foam. The powerful jet turbines accelerated the ship almost like an automobile.
"Romeo, Hammer, warning, warning, the target just fired a fish at you."
"Nixie?" Morris asked. The ship was moving too fast for her own sonar to work.
"One in the water and another ready to stream, sir," a petty officer responded.
"That's it, then," Morris said. He reached into his pocket for a cigarette, looked at it, then tossed the whole pack into a waste can.
"Romeo, Hammer, this contact is a Type 2 engine plant. I evaluate this contact as a Victor class. Now at full speed, turning north. Your torp is pinging the target. We've lost the fish he sent your way."
"Roger. Stick with the sub, Hammer."
"Aren't you one cool bastard?" O'Malley said into the intercom.
He could see smoke rising from HMS Illustrious.
"Idiot," the pilot said to himself. "You shouldn't have dropped the first torp."
All he could do now was ping.
"Skipper, the torp just went to continuous ping. It seems to be closing the target. Ping interval is shortening.
Hull popping noise. The sub is changing depth again. Coming up, I think."
O'Malley saw a disturbance in the water. Suddenly, the spherical bow of the Victor came through the surface. The submarine had lost depth control, trying to evade the fish. What followed a moment later was the first warhead explosion O'Malley had ever really seen. The submarine was sliding back down when a plume of water appeared 100 feet from where the bow had poked up.
"Romeo, Hammer, that was a hit. I saw the son of a bitch. Say again, that's a hit."
Morris checked with his sonar officer. They hadn't picked up the Russian torpedo's homing sonar. It had missed. Captain Perrin scarcely believed it. The Oscar had taken 3 torpedo hits so far, and still there were no breaking up noises. But the machinery noise had stopped, and he had the submarine on his active sonar.
Battle axe closed at 15 knots when the black shape appeared amid a mass of bubbles on the surface. The captain ran to the bridge and put his binoculars on the Russian ship. The sub was a bare mile away. A man appeared atop the submarine's sail, waving wildly.
"Check fire! Check fire!" he screamed. "Ship control, bring us alongside quick as you can!"
He didn't believe it. The Oscar showed a pair of jagged rents on her upper hull and floated with a 30-degree list from the ruptured ballast tanks. Men were scrambling out of the sail and the forward deck hatch. "Bravo, Romeo, we just killed a Victor-class inshore. Please advise your situation, over." Perrin lifted the phone. "Romeo, we have a wounded Oscar on the surface. The crew is abandoning ship. He fired 2 missiles. Our Sea Wolves splashed one. The other hit India in the bows. We are preparing to conduct rescue operations. Tell November that he may continue his promenade. Over."
"Way to go, Bravo. Out."
He switched channels. "November, this is Romeo. Did you copy Bravo's last transmission? Over."
"Affirmative, Romeo. Let's get this parade to the beach."
General Andreev took the report from the observation post himself before handing the radio phone to his operations officer. The American landing ships were now 5 kilometers from Akranis Lighthouse. They'd proceed probably to the old whaling station in Falfjordr to wait their chance.
"We will resist to the end," the KGB colonel said. "We'll show them how Soviet soldiers can fight."
"I admire your spirit, Comrade Colonel." He walked over to the corner and picked up a rifle. "Here, you may take this to the front yourself."
"But..."
"Lieutenant Gasparenko, get the colonel a driver. He's going to the front to show the Americans how Soviet soldiers fight." Andreev watched with dark amusement. The Czechist could not back down. After he was gone, the general summoned his divisional communications officer. All long-range radio transmitters except for 2 would be destroyed. Andreev knew he could not surrender yet. His troopers would have to pay a bill in blood first, and the general would suffer for every drop. But he knew it would soon reach a point at which further resistance was futile, and he would not sacrifice his men for nothing. Alfeld, Federal Republic of Germany. It was over for a while. The second attack had nearly done it, McCall thought. The Russians had run their tanks flat out and gotten to within 50 yards of the American positions, close enough that their old, obsolete cannon had destroyed half of the troops' tanks. But that attack had faltered on the brink of success, and the third attack at dusk was a half-hearted affair, executed by men too tired to advance into the kill zone. He could hear the noise behind him of another action underway. The Germans west of the town were under heavy attack. Stendal, German Democratic Republic. General Beregovoy reports a heavy counterattack from the north, towards Alfeld. Alexeyev accepted the news impassively. His gamble had failed.
That's why it's called gambling, Pasha.
Now what? It was very quiet in the map room. The junior officers who plotted the movements of friendly and enemy forces had never talked much, and now were not even looking over to the other map sectors. It was no longer a race to see whose forces got to their objectives first.
"The word you're looking for is gloom, Pasha."
The general stood next to his operations officer.
"Yevgeny Ilyich, I am open to suggestions."
He shrugged.
"We must continue. Our troops are tired. So are theirs.
We're throwing inexperienced troops against veterans. We have to change that. We will take officers and NCOs from the A units that are off the line and use them to beef up the C units now arriving. These reservists must have experienced combat soldiers to leaven their ranks, else we send them like cattle to the slaughter. Next, we will temporarily suspend offensive operations."
"Comrade General, if we do that..."
"We have enough strength for one last hard push. That push will be at the time and place of my choosing, and it will be a fully prepared attack.
I will order Beregovoy to escape the best way he can. I cannot trust that order to the radio. Yevgeny Ilyich, I want you to fly to Beregovoy's headquarters tonight. You'll need a good operational brain to assist him. That will be your assignment. I'll give you a chance to redeem yourself, you traitorous bastard. Use it well. More importantly, it got the KGB informer out of the way. The operations officer walked off to arrange transport. Alexeyev took Sergeyev back into his office. You're going back to Moscow. Chapter 42. The Resolution of Conflict. Brussels, Belgium.
Amazing what a pair of fives can do.
What's that, General? His intelligence chief inquired.
Sackyer shook his head, looking at the map with confidence for once.
Alfeld held. A couplet, the general thought. The Germans to the west had taken a murderous pounding, but while their lines had bent, they hadn't broken. More help was on the way. A tank brigade was en route to reinforce them. The newly arrived armored division was pressing south now to isolate this Russian division from those on the Weser. The farthest advanced Russian divisions had shot out their supply of surface-to-air missiles, and NATO air power was blasting their positions with grim regularity. Aerial reconnaissance showed the open ground east of Alfeld to be a charnel house of burned-out tanks. Reinforcements were heading there also. Ivan would be back, but skies were clearing again. The full weight of NATO aircraft was coming into play.
Joachim, I think we've stopped them.
Ja, Herr General. Now we'll begin to drive them back. Moscow, RSFSR.
Father, General Alexeyev has ordered me to tell you that he does not think it possible to defeat NATO.
You are certain?
Yes, Father.
The young man sat down in the minister's office. We failed to achieve strategic surprise. We underestimated NATO's air power. Too many things. We failed to prevent NATO's resupply. Except for that last counterattack, it might have worked, but... There is one more chance. The general is suspending offensive operations in preparation for a final attack. To do this...
If all is lost, what is this you're talking about?
If we can damage the NATO forces sufficiently to forestall a major counteroffensive, we will hold on to our gains, enabling the Politburo to negotiate from a position of strength. Even this is uncertain, but it is the best option the general sees. He asks that you put it to the Politburo that a diplomatic settlement is necessary, and quickly, before NATO recovers its strength sufficiently for their own offensive. The minister nodded. He turned in his chair to look out the window for a few minutes, while his son waited for a response.
Before that is possible, the minister said finally, they will order Alexeyev's arrest. You know what's happened to the others they arrested, don't you?
It took his son a moment to grasp the father's words.
They couldn't have.
Last night, all seven of them, including your former commander-in-chief.
But he was an effective commander.
He failed, Vanya, the elder Sergeyev said quietly.
The state does not suffer failure gladly, and I have allied myself, for your sake, with Alexeyev.
His voice trailed off.
I have no choice now. I must cooperate with Kossoff, bastard or not, consequences or not.
And I must risk your life also, Vanya.
Vitali will take you to the dacha. You will change into civilian clothes and wait for me. You will not go outside. You will not allow yourself to be seen by anyone.
But surely you are being watched.
Of course. His father smiled briefly. I am being watched by officers of the Committee for State Security, officers of Kossoff's personal staff.
And if he plays you for a fool?
Then I am a dead man, Vanya, and so are you.
Forgive me, I never dreamed that something like this would...
You have made me very proud these last few weeks.
He rose and embraced his son.
Go now, you must trust me.
After his son left, Sergeyev lifted his phone and dialed KGB headquarters. Director Kossoff was out, and the petroleum minister left a message that the figures Kossoff had requested on oil production in the Gulf states were ready. The meeting requested by the minister's use of the code phrase took place soon after sunset. By midnight, Ivan Mikhailovich was again on a plane bound for Germany. Stendal, German Democratic Republic. Director Kossoff applauds your method for dealing with the traitor. He said that killing him, even accidentally, would have aroused suspicion. But now that he is safely behind enemy lines and doing his duty, they will be certain that he is not under suspicion. The next time you see the bastard, tell him thank you. Your friend was shot 36 hours ago, Sergeyev said next. The general snapped to rigid attention.
What?
The former commander-in-chief West was shot, along with Marshal Shavirin, Roshkov, 4 others.
And that fucking Kossoff congratulates me for...
He said there was nothing he could do about it, and offers his condolences. Condolences from the Committee for State Security, Alexeyev thought. There will come a time, Comrade Kossoff. I am next, of course. You were right to have me float your rationale for future operations with my father. He and Kossoff both feel that for you to propose this to Stavka would mean your instant arrest. The Politburo still feels that victory is possible. When they lose that belief, anything can happen. Alexeyev knew exactly what anything meant. Go on. Your idea to put experienced troops in the arriving C divisions has merit. Anyone will see that. A number of such divisions are cycling through Moscow every day. Sergeyev halted to allow his general to draw his own conclusions. The general's whole body appeared to shudder.
Vanya, you are talking treason.
We are talking about the survival of the motherland. Do not confuse the importance of your own skin with the importance of our country. You are a soldier, Ivan Mikhailovich, as am I. Our lives are expendable pawns.
For our political leadership? Sergeyev scoffed.
Your respect for the party comes late, Comrade General. I hope that your father could persuade the Politburo to a more moderate course of action. I did not intend to incite a rebellion.
The time for moderation is long past, Sergeyev replied, speaking like a young party chieftain.
My father spoke against the war, as did others, to no avail. If you propose a diplomatic solution, you will be arrested and shot, first for failing to achieve your assigned objective, second for daring to propose political policy to the party hierarchy. With whom would you be replaced? And what would be the result? My father fears that the Politburo will lean towards a nuclear resolution of the conflict.
My father was right, Sergeyev thought. For all his anger at the party, Alexeyev has served the state too long and too well to allow himself to think realistically of treason.
The party and the revolution have been betrayed, Comrade General. If we do not save them, both are lost. My father says that you must decide whom and what you serve.
And if I decide wrongly?
Then I will die, and my father, and others. And you will not have saved yourself.
He's right. He's right on all things. The revolution has been betrayed. The idea of the party has been betrayed. But
you try to manipulate me like a child. Your father told you that I would not cooperate unless you convinced me of the idealistic... The general sputtered for a moment, seeking the right word.
Rightness, rightness of your action.
My father told me that you have been conditioned, just as the science of communism says men can be conditioned. You have been told all your life that the army serves the party, that you are the guardian of the state. He told me to remind you that you are a man of the party, that it is time for the people to reclaim the party for themselves.
Ah, this is why he conspires with the director of the KGB.
Perhaps you would prefer that we have some bearded priests from the Orthodox Church, or some dissident Jews from the Gulag to make the revolution a pure one.
We must fight with what we have.
It was heady wine indeed for Sergeyev to talk this way to a man with whom he had served under fire. But he knew that his father was right. Twice in 50 years the party had broken the army to its will. For all their pride and power, the generals of the Soviet army had as much instinct for rebellion as a lapdog.
But once the decision is made, his father had told him,
"The Rodina cries out for rescue, Comrade General."
"Don't tell me about the motherland."
"The party is the soul of the people."
Alexeyev remembered the slogan for 1,000 repetitions.
"Then what of the children of Pskov?"
"The KGB did that."
"Do you blame the sword for the hand that wields it?
If so, what does that make you?"
Alexeyev wavered.
"It is not an easy thing to overturn the state, Ivan Mikhailovich.
Comrade General, is it your duty to carry out orders that will only bring about its destruction?"
"We do not seek to overturn the state," Sergeyev said gently. "We seek to restore the state."
"We will probably fail."
Alexeyev took a perverse comfort in the statement. He sat down at his desk.
"But if I must die, better that it should be as a man than a dog."
The general took out a pad of paper and a pencil. He began to formulate a plan to ensure that they would not fail, and that he would not die until he had accomplished at least one thing. Hill 914, Iceland. They were good troops up there, Colonel Lowe knew. Nearly all of the division's artillery was lashing the hill, plus continuous air attacks, plus the battleship's 5-inch guns. He watched his troops advancing up the steep slopes under fire from the remaining Russians. The battle wagons were close inshore, delivering VT proximity rounds from their secondary batteries. The shells exploded 20 feet or so from the ground in ugly black puffs that sprayed the hill with fragments, while the Marines' own heavy guns plowed up the hilltop. Every few minutes the artillery would stop for a moment to allow the aircraft to swoop in with napalm and cluster bombs. And still the Russians fought back.
"Now, move the choppers now," Lowe ordered.
10 minutes later, he heard the stuttering sound of rotors as 15 helicopters passed his command post to the east, curving around the back side of the hill. His artillery coordinator called to halt the fire briefly as the two companies of men landed on the hill's southern rim. They were supported by Sea Cobra attack choppers and advanced at a run toward the Russian positions on the northern crests. The Russian commander was wounded, and his second-in-command was slow to realize that he had enemy troops in his rear. When he did, a hopeless situation became one of despair. The word got out slowly. Many of the Russian radios were destroyed. Some of the troopers never got the word and had to be killed in their holes. But they were the exceptions. Most heard the diminishing fire and saw the raised hands. With a mixture of shame and relief, they disabled their weapons and waited for capture. The battle for the hill had lasted 4 hours.
"Hill 914 does not answer, Comrade General," the communications officer said.
"It's hopeless," Andreev muttered to himself.
His artillery was destroyed. His SAMs were gone. He'd been ordered to hold the island for only a few weeks, been promised seaborne reinforcement, been told that the war in Europe would last 2 weeks, 4 at the most. He'd held longer than that. One of his regiments had been destroyed north of Reykjavik, and now that the Americans had Hill 914, they could see into the island's capital. 2,000 of his men were dead or missing, another 1,000 wounded. It was enough.
"See if you can raise the American commander on the radio. Say that I request a ceasefire and desire to meet with him at a place of his choosing."
USS Nassau.
"So, you're Beagle."
"Yes, General."
Edwards tried to sit up a little straighter in the bed. The tubes in his arm and the cast on his leg didn't help. The landing ship's hospital was full of wounded men.
"And this must be Miss Vigdis,"
They told me you were pretty. I have a daughter about your age.
The Navy corpsman had gotten her clothes that nearly fit. A doctor had examined her and pronounced her pregnancy normal and healthy. She was rested and bathed. To Mike and everyone else who had seen her, she was a reminder of better times and better things.
Except for Michael, I would be dead.
So I've heard. Is there anything you need, miss? She looked down at Edwards, and that answered the question.
You've done pretty well for a weatherman, Lieutenant.
Sir, all we did was keep out of the way.
No. You told us what Ivan had on this rock, and where they were.
Well, at least where they weren't.
You and your people did a lot more than just keep out of the way, son.
The general pulled a small box out of his pocket.
Well done, Marine.
Sir, I'm Air Force.
Oh, yeah? Well, this here says you're a Marine.
The general pinned a Navy cross to his pillow. A major approached the general and handed him a message form. The general pocketed it and looked down the rows of hospital beds.
About time, he breathed. Miss Vigdis, would you please look after this man for us?
Sverdlovsk, RSFSR. 2 more days and they'd be leaving for the front. The 77th Motor Rifle Division was a Category C unit, and, like all such units, was composed of reservists in their 30s and possessed a little over a third of its normal outlay of equipment. Since mobilization, they had been training incessantly, the older men with military experience passing along their knowledge to the newly inducted conscripts. It was a strange match. The young arrivals were physically fit, but ignorant of military life. The older men remembered much of their own military service, but had softened with age. The young men had the ardor of youth, and as much as they naturally feared exposure to danger on the battlefield, they would not hesitate to defend their country. The older men with families had much more to lose. Lectures to their officers from a veteran combat officer had filtered down to the ranks. Germany would not be pleasant. A sergeant from communications received the message, and the word got out quickly. Experienced combat officers and NCOs would join them at Moscow. The experienced reservists knew that they'd need such men to teach them the lessons hard won at the front. They knew something else it meant. The 77th Motor Rifle Division would be committed to action within a week. It was quiet that night in the encampment. Men stood outside the unheated barracks, looking at the pine forests on the eastern slopes of the Ural Mountains.
Moscow, RSFSR.
Why are we not attacking? The general secretary demanded.
General Alexeyev has informed me that he is preparing for a major attack now. He says he needs time to organize his forces for a weighted blow, Bukharin answered.
You tell Comrade General Alexeyev, the defense minister said, that we want action, not words.
Comrades, Sergeyev said, I seem to recall from my own military service that one should not attack until one has a decisive advantage in men and weapons. If we order Alexeyev to attack before he is ready, we condemn our army to failure. We must give him time to do his job properly.
And now you are an expert on defense matters? The defense minister inquired. A pity you are not so expert in your own field, or we should not be in this predicament.
Comrade Minister, I told you that your projections for oil use at the front were overly optimistic, and I was correct. You said, give us the fuel, and we'll see it is properly used, did you not? You said a 2-week campaign, 4 at the worst, did you not?
Sergeyev looked around the table. Such expertise as this has brought us to disaster.
We will not fail. We will defeat the West.
Comrades, Kossoff walked into the room, forgive me for being late. I just received notification that our forces on Iceland are surrendering. The general in command cites 30% casualties and a hopeless tactical situation.
Have him arrested at once, defense roared, and arrest the family of the traitor.
Our comrade defense minister seems far more efficient in arresting our own people than in defeating our enemies,
Sergeyev observed dryly.
"You young whelp!"
The defense minister went white with rage.
"I do not say that we have been defeated, but it is clear that we have not yet been victorious. It is time that we seek a political conclusion to this war."
"We could accept the German terms," the foreign minister said hopefully.
"I regret to inform you that this is no longer a possibility," Kossoff replied. "I have reason to believe that this was a sham, a German maskirovka."
"But your deputy said only the day before yesterday."
"I warned him and you that I had my doubts. A story appeared today in the French newspaper Le Monde that the Germans have rejected a Soviet offer for a political settlement to the war. They give the correct times and location that the meetings took place. The story could only have come from official German channels, and the clear implication is that this was all along a NATO effort to affect our strategic thinking. They are sending us a message, comrades. They say that they are prepared to fight the war to the finish."
"Marshal Bukharin, what is the strength of the NATO forces?" the General Secretary asked.
"They have taken massive losses in men and materiel. Their armies are exhausted. They must be, else they would have counterattacked in strength already."
"One more push, then," Defense said. He looked to the head of the table for support.
"One more very, very hard push. Perhaps Alexeyev is right. We need to coordinate a single massive attack to smash their lines."
"Now you are grasping at other men's straws," Sergeyev thought.
"The Defense Council will consider this in private," the General Secretary said.
"No," Sergeyev objected. "This is now a political question for the entire Politburo. The fate of the country will not be decided by 5 men only."
"You have no place to object, Mikhail Eduardovich. You have no vote at this table."
Sergeyev was stunned to hear these words from Kossoff.
"Perhaps he should," Bromkovsky said.
"That is not a question to be decided now," the General Secretary announced. Sergeyev watched the faces arrayed around the oak table. No one had the courage to speak up now. He had almost altered the power balance of the Politburo, but until it was clear which faction was stronger, the old rules would prevail. The meeting adjourned. The members filed out except for the 5 Defense Council members, who kept Bukharin with them. The candidate member lingered outside looking for allies. His fellow chieftains filed past. Several met his eyes, then looked away.
"Mikhail Eduardovich," it was the Minister for Agriculture, "how much fuel will be available for food distribution?"
"How much food will there be?" Sergeyev asked.
"How much food can there be?"
"More than you think. We have tripled the size of private plots throughout the Russian Republic."
"What?"
"Yes, the old people on the farms are growing plenty of food now, at least enough to feed us for the time being. The problem is now one of distribution."
"No one told me."
"Some good news?" Sergeyev wondered.
"Do you know how many times I have proposed this?
No, you weren't here last July, were you? I've said for years that by doing this we could solve many problems. And finally they listened to me. We have food, Mikhail Eduardovich. I just hope we will have people to eat it. I need fuel to transport it to the cities.
Well, I have the fuel."
"I will see what I can do, Filip Moiseyevich."
"You have spoken well, comrade. I hope some will listen."
"Thank you."
"Your son is well?"
"The last I heard from him, yes."
"I am ashamed that my son is not there, too."
The Minister for Agriculture paused.
"We must... well, we have no time for that now. Get me the fuel figures as quickly as you can."
"A convert? Or an agent provocateur?"
Stendal, German Democratic Republic. Alexeyev held the message in his hand. Fly at once to Moscow for consultations. Was it his death sentence? The general summoned his deputy.
"Nothing new. We have some probes around Hamburg and what looks like preparations for an attack north of Hanover, but nothing we should not be able to handle."
"I have to go to Moscow."
Alexeyev saw the concern on the man's face. Don't worry, Anatoly. I haven't been in command long enough to be shot. We will have to arrange our personnel transfers in a systematic way if we have any hope of transforming these C divisions into a fighting force. I should be back in 24 hours or less. Tell Major Sergeyev to get my map case and meet me outside in 10 minutes. Alexeyev handed his aide the message form in the back of the staff car, along with an ironic look. What does this mean? We'll find out in a few hours, Vanya. Moscow, RSFSR.
They are truly mad.
You should choose your words with greater care, Boris Georgievich, Sergeyev said. What has NATO done now? The KGB chief shook his head in surprise.
I mean the Defense Council, you young fool.
This young fool has no vote on the Politburo. You pointed that out yourself. Sergeyev had held the fleeting hope that the Politburo might be brought to its senses.
Mikhail Eduardovich, I have worked very hard to protect you to this point. Please do not make me regret this. If you had managed to force a Politburo decision in the open, you would have lost and possibly destroyed yourself. As it is... Kossoff paused for another of his grins. As it is, they have asked me to discuss their decision with you in hope of getting your support.
They are doubly mad, Kossoff went on. First, the defense minister wishes to initiate the use of a few small tactical nuclear warheads. Second, he hopes for your support. They propose the Maskirovka all over again. They will explode a small tactical device in the DDR, forcing us to retaliate while proclaiming that NATO has violated the No First Use Agreement.
But it could be worse. They've summoned Alexeyev to Moscow to seek his assessment of the plan and how best to implement it. He should be on his way here now.
The Politburo will never agree to this. We're not all crazy, are we? Have you told them how NATO will react?
Of course. I've told them that NATO will not react at all at first. They will be too confused.
You encouraged them?
I wish you would keep in mind that they prefer Larionov's opinions to my own.
Comrade Kossoff, Sergeyev thought to himself,
you care less about the danger to the Rodina than you do for your own future. You'd be quite satisfied to bring the whole country down if you bring them down first, wouldn't you?
The votes on the Politburo.
We'll support the Defense Council.
Think.
Rumkovsky will vote no, perhaps agriculture also, though I doubt it. They want you to speak in favor of the plan. This will reduce the opposition to old Petya. Petya is a good old man, but no one really listens to him anymore.
I will never do this.
But you must.
And Alexeyev must agree.
Kossoff got up and looked out the window. There is nothing to fear. No nuclear bombs will be used. I have already seen to that.
What do you mean?
Surely you know who controls the nuclear weapons in this country.
Certainly the strategic rocket forces, the army's artillerymen.
Excuse me, I phrased my question poorly. Yes, they control the rockets. It is my people who control the warheads, and Joseph Larionov's faction does not include that segment of the KGB.
This is why you must play along.
Very well. Then we must warn Alexeyev.
With caution now. No one seems to have noticed that your son has made several trips to Moscow, but if you are seen with General Alexeyev before he meets with them...
Yes, I can understand that.
Sergeyev thought for a moment.
Perhaps Vitaly can meet them at the airport and pass a message.
Very good. I will make a Czechist of you yet.
The minister's driver was summoned and handed a written note. He departed at once, taking the minister's zeal out toward the airport. A military convoy of wheeled armored personnel carriers held him up. 40 minutes later... he noticed that his gas gauge was down.
Odd, he'd just filled the car up the day before. The Politburo members were never short of anything. But it kept dropping. Then the